God save the state of Texas and this honorable city.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket, and the order of the presentation they are as follows. Thelma Huvenak versus the San Jacinto Gas Transmission Company from Fort Bend County and the First Appellate District, consolidated for oral argument with eight other causes that I won't read. If you're here for them, you'll know what they are. Union Pacific Resources Group Incorporated and others versus Lowell F. Hankins and others from Crockett County and the 8th Appellate District, and American Manufacturers Mutual Insurance Company and others versus Gary Schieffer and others from Jefferson County and the 9th Appellate District. In each of these matters, the court is allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioners may reserve a portion of their time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a recess in between each oral argument and complete the arguments by noon. Each argument is being recorded by our clerk, and you may purchase an audio tape of an argument for a nominal fee by seeing our clerk. Justices O'Neill and Schneider are not sitting in the first matter. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Huvenak versus San Jacinto Gas and other cases.
Next in court, Mr. William D. Dole and Mr. Richard L. McAleer will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioners have reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Dole will open with the first 10 minutes. Mr. McAleer will present the rebuttal.
May it please the court. These nine cases are before the court on the trial court's handling of the landowner's plea to the jurisdiction in these condemnation proceedings. The nine cases can be divided into two groups. The first five cause numbers, 213 through 217, were handled in the trial court on traditional cross motions for partial summary judgment on the jurisdictional prerequisite of good faith negotiation, which is required in the condemnation proceeding. The last four cases, 321, 322, 320, 321, 326, and 359, were all handled in the trial court in a supplemental hearing on the landowner's supplemental plea to jurisdiction, an evidentiary hearing. And after that evidentiary hearing, the trial court entered its order of dismissal. So they're two different procedural ways these cases are before the court.
In the summary judgment cases, was one of the grounds in the summary judgment that the landowners did not really pipeline across their land at all?
That was stated by some of the landowners.
But was that a basis for the motion for partial summary judgment?
Not directly. I mean, they included in the condemning authorities included in their summary judgment evidence notes by the negotiators of comments that the landowners made. However, on a procedural matter, that would be an affirmative defense if they're going to claim that negotiations were futile because the landowner never would have agreed to any kind of easement, and they did not plead futility of negotiations. So, as an affirmative defense, which would be an excuse for them not to make a good faith offer. It's clearly an affirmative defense they didn't include. But I think before you even get to that question, the first question is, would the pipeline company have ever made an offer for only the rights that they condemned? They have judicially admitted in this court in a prior Huvenak case, 010294, in their brief on the merits and in their motion for rehearing. They said, in quote, referring to the three rights that are at issue, the right to transport any substance that can be pushed through a pipeline, something no condemning authority in Texas can condemn.
If the court concludes that a condemning authority to constitute good faith negotiations if the court concludes that the mere fact that the condemning authority attempts to obtain more rights through its offer to purchase than it could through condemnation, is there anything left in the cases to review on the good faith question?
No, that is
And so really what we're talking, we're really not talking about any sort of factual dispute that's going on about the negotiation. We're simply talking about the question of law. Can, if all they can condemn is certain rights, is it, can, is it, as a matter of law, bad faith if they attempt, if the only offer they make is for more rights than they could get in condemnation?
Effectively, that's correct, but I want to make sure.
I'm just trying to figure out what it is we have to decide in this case.
I think that's the basic point is, if the condemnor admits that they would never make an offer to a landowner for only the rights they can condemn, is that bad faith as a matter of law? I believe it is, because it's arbitrary. Why won't you make an offer for only the rights you can condemn?
Under your theory, do we have to decide whether they could have condemned for the final easement or whether they could have condemned the easement for a liquid pipeline?
No, for several reasons, Your Honor. First of all, they've admitted they're a gas utility and that they do not have the power to condemn for anything other than the
pipeline. Well, I thought all gas pipelines showed some liquids.
Well,
that's what they get picked for, get the liquid.
Right, pipeline. That's right. I mean, there's some entrained in the stream of gas, but no one's claiming that they're trespassing because of this entrained gas.
And I also thought that these routine and assigned, for example, if the company was bought out by this another utility, they were routine and assigned that carbon payment to these companies.
It really depends on the easement document itself, Your Honor. As the court struggled with the issue in the Marcus Cable case, and they noted in that case that they handed down their decision in November, the easement was specifically assigned. In this case, they have admitted that they did not even try to condemn the right to assign.
But I'm saying, are you saying that no easement that was obtained by condemnation in Texas, if the company is sold, for example, that the easement is permanent? Is that your position?
If they didn't condemn the right to assign it, and I believe that you cannot condemn the right to assign it. The court has ordered briefs on the merits in the case of some pipeline companies. William Bell with the Exxon Pipeline Company. I will present the court with about 30 pages of why. I don't think you can condemn the right to assign, and even if you can condemn the right to assign, you have to at least plead that you're trying to acquire the right to assign the easement. The case goes back really to Alley versus Carlton about an 1867 Texas Supreme Court case that said easements in gross, which are easements that do not benefit the land across which they go, are not assignable absent an agreement between the parties. And that makes sense because if it doesn't benefit your property, you certainly don't want to burden subsequent owners with it. So it has to be assignable by agreement. The Orange County versus Citgo Petroleum case very clearly defines the pipeline easements for easements in growth.
How does the fact that a pipeline must carry liquids as opposed to natural gas liquids in the stream change the burden on the suburban estate or the value of the easement?
Well, they have different habits. As an example, if it's a gas liquid pipeline, such as ethane, something like that, where it's heavier than air, you can have a leak. It's natural gas that dissipates the atmosphere. Have gas liquids, somewhat like a seminal, that will hover on the ground and migrate along the ground.
I mean, is there evidence that the difference of what's carrying pipelines affects the value of these?
Not in these particular cases, but in this record. There are various appraisers that have various opinions on that issue. Again, that goes back to they're demanding that they be granted rights that they cannot condemn. We're talking about rights. Let's put it, that's kind of abstract. Let's put it into something concrete. Texas Highway Department comes along and says, the Transportation Board says we need 20 feet to widen some street or some highway. All right, they need 20 feet. Well, what if the Highway Department comes along and says, you know what? The Transportation Board doesn't know what they're doing. We're going to demand the landowner to give us 100 feet in width. Even though we only need 20 feet, we want 100 feet. And under the pipeline company's theory, if they go out and get an appraiser and appraise that 100 feet and offer what they think the 100 feet is worth, then they comply qualified with good faith and dedication? I don't think so. Because you can only condemn what is necessary.
But on that point, though, the buyer doesn't have to sell 100 feet.
Well, you see, this is condemnation.
All right,
and so in order not to be sued, the seller is going to have to sell 100 feet. Because
what if, in your example, condemning authority offers money for 100 feet, and the response is, no, I'm not going to sell any of it. I'm not going to sell a fee. I'm not going to sell an easement. Go away. If the offer gets that definitive an answer, have you complied with good faith? In other words, your status.
I don't think so, because I think the duty upon them is to make a good faith offer. In this case, they have admitted that they never would have accepted an offer for only that which doesn't condemn. You're putting people, and really, the people that are being harmed by this are not necessarily the clients that we represent. It's all the people out there that received that final offer letter that said, here's our easement, here's our dollar offer, and if you don't sign this, we're going to condemn you. Who wants to be sued? Anybody want to be sued?
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court. My name is Tom Sheffield.
You haven't been introduced yet.
I'm sorry.
May it please the court. This is Tom Sheffield, and this is Ken Rady. We'll present argument for the respondent. Mr. Sheffield, over to the first 15 minutes.
My apologies to the court. I think I may have also committed the faux pas wearing a bicolor suit. I'm certainly a little offended by that. I think that the issues in all of these cases are reasonably well joined, and I think they've been briefed to the point of confession, frankly. I think that it has always to be enough if you offer somebody more than what their property is worth, never mind, frankly, what any of the ancillary rights.
Where's the evidence in the record that says that if you back out the ancillary rights, your offer was more than what the property could be worth?
Why? Let me answer the question this way. I don't think there's any evidence in the record from which you can draw an inference that the inclusion or exclusion of any of those rights would have affected market value and the amount of compensation that should have been offered.
We just don't know one way or the other from the record.
No, we don't. But I think that the fact that futility is conclusively shown when, as in Cubanac or Cusack, the company makes an offer and in no uncertain terms they're told we don't want a pipeline on the property.
But
I think that satisfies that standard.
But if this court defines good faith offer to be a reasonableness standard based on the rights that are being requested and the interests that are being negotiated over, you would never have a decision about the threshold that wouldn't require a jury finding, would you? I mean, if we said, well, good faith really depends on how much you offered based on the ancillary rights you're requesting, we would never get past a fact question on the threshold of whether or not there was a good faith offer.
Well, I think that may be right.
Do you have a rule, if good faith is a threshold of bringing condemnation, do you have a rule that would help us determine when, let me go the other way, when the offer was not bona fide? Or the offer was not in good faith, or something that doesn't depend on balancing the amount you offer versus the rights you possess.
I understand. And the case that always comes to my mind is City of Houston versus Hammond, in which the City of Houston negotiated for an abrogation easement, a flyover easement on the property. That's what they negotiated for. What they condemned, however, was a fee simple interest in the property. And I think there's a presumption at play in those cases that that would most certainly have an impact on market value. Court in that case said that was not good faith. We have the opposite situation with the things in these cases where the company negotiated for more rights than it may or may not have been able to condemn. And the lawyer is truly simply made a judgment about what to condemn and what not to condemn, what's worth fighting about and what's not worth fighting about. The landowners in these cases don't argue about any of that. As to the rule of law, I think, although HIP and Dow and some of the other cases don't come right out and say it, I think what the rule of law should be is this. Is there sufficient evidence for a condemning authority to come to the reasonable conclusion that the parties are not willing to agree on damages? And I think that on the evidence overwhelming each and every one of these cases. Mr. Mill, for instance, the appraised amount of the property was $17,000, something like that. Mr. Donnell immediately says, before he ever sees a final offer letter or a formed right-of-way agreement, I want $120,000. The company was not willing to pay $120,000, a factor of five over the appraised value. And I think it's reasonable at that point to come to the conclusion that the parties are not going to.
Do you agree that futility is an affirmative defense?
No, I do not.
Why not?
The only authority for the proposition that it is Madison Rayburn's treatise on condemnation. I think the pleading requirements for a good faith for a condemnation case are exclusively contained in section 21.02 of the property code, which, by the way, doesn't mean like good faith, higher duties, or anything of that nature. What it says is that you have to prove that the parties are unable to agree.
Do you concede then that there would be some evidence that it was that it was not a good faith negotiation if the utility offered $10,000 and the buyer came back and said he wouldn't accept less than $12,000, and then that was it?
I think that's sufficient to establish good faith negotiations. I think, frankly, that it would be a horse race if I think that if you're going to complain about these three ancillary issues, once the condemning authority has met its burden of proof, conclusively shown the fact of futility or inability to agree. Frankly, I think if you're going to say that these three ancillary rights have something to do with the likelihood of your signing an agreement, I think you, as a landowner, need to come down to the courthouse.
Let me explore that with you. So the utility offers $5,000 based on their appraisal, and the buyer comes back and says, I'm not going to sell it for less than $10,000 based on his appraisal. You say that's a good faith offer.
Good faith negotiation.
Well, so they would not have the opportunity to come forward and say that your appraiser was employed by the utility and he had a memo that said you are supposed to offer half of what the market value of the property is. You don't think you could proceed under your standard of what's reasonably offered?
Well, I think that's a different circumstance. If the condemning authority says we're going to offer half of what the market value is, I think that would be a situation of good faith. But that doesn't obtain in any of these cases because the landowners are consistently offered, frankly, more than what the property is worth.
But there's no offer on the proposed condemned property. In other
that
words,
that
so how
right.
So how can you say there's a disagreement about the damages on for which there would be a condemnation
if there is
no offer precisely tied to that property?
Well, there's no evidence in the record that any of those terms have an impact on the market.
Whose burden would that be to present evidence on that issue?
I think it would be the landowner. Once the condemning authority has an appraisal or a pipeline easement.
But the condemning authority has the obligation to show an inability to agree.
That's
is that right?
Right?
And so wouldn't they have to show that an offer for the property that is subject to condemnation would not have been accepted?
I don't think you have to show that. I mean, if you've been acting Cusack, I think clearly the law is that the party, or that the condemning authority, can negotiate for anything that any other party may want to negotiate for the voluntary transfer of use.
Well, how do you know the landowner is unable to agree on the property if there's not been an offer for that property? Wouldn't that be your obligation to show that?
I don't think it matters. Once the condemning authority has met the relevant legal standard, I think that the landowner has to prove that it would have made a difference in the market value of the property. These are ancillary rights in the right-of-way agreement, the form agreement for consent. I don't think it's the case that the condemning authority has to disprove every conceivable negative concerning the materiality of terms contained in the right-of-way easement. For instance, it contains a lot of terms like relocate the pipeline, put up cathodic test protection leads and pipeline markers and the like. I don't think it's the case that a condemning authority has to go through all of those terms and disprove the negative and show that they would not have had an impact on market value unless the landowners joined them.
But why wouldn't the rule of law that we're talking about here be simpler by saying, at the very minimum, the condemning authority must make an offer on the land that is proposed to be condemned? And then they can start there, and then there's all kinds of negotiations that can happen with respect to ancillary rights, but at the very least do that.
Well, I don't think on the facts of any of these cases that would have made a difference. If that happened, the rule before any of these cases were filed, then that's just another proof for a condemning authority to jump through, and they could very well have done that. What's offensive about the Durnell opinion is that it's retroactive. There's nothing you can do about that now. No one knew that the Durnell court was going to say, this is what you have to do.
Do you agree with Mr. Noel that really the only issue in this case is whether or not the mere fact that the utility requested ancillary rights that they could not get under condemnation established that the negotiation was not in good faith?
That is precisely.
And so if the court concludes that it is not in bad faith to request ancillary rights as a part of the negotiating tool, that's the end of this case.
That is the end of this case. That I believe is.
And we don't get into arguing whether they offered more money or less money or whatever based on those rights.
I think it's important to keep in mind that the good faith negotiation requirements too, there's merely a condition preceding the final lawsuit.
What does that mean?
It doesn't raise a constitutional issue in the eminent domain case because there's no taking until such a time as there's administrative hearing and possession of the property is taken.
Is it jurisdictional?
That's a good question. I know the court drops that footnote in either the Hip or the Down case. I don't think that the court needs to reach that issue because I think all of the cases should be affirmed with the exception of Durnell and its two sister cases, which should be reversed and rendered on this legal issue.
But it makes a big practical difference. Whether you're dealing with a pending case that you can go back and fix, or whether you never had a case to start with.
Yeah, it makes an enormous difference which way it's treated. If the court were to find a bad faith, and what happens is the case gets dismissed, if it is jurisdictional, and you pay a hefty load of penalties due to the landowner in terms of attorney's fees and statute, if there is damages and the like. In keeping with the spirit of the rule, which is to keep the parties from going to the courthouse if it's not necessary, I think that, frankly, it probably should be treated not unlike a DCPA demand letter in case it be abated. And then we could all find out for sure if the court thought that there was a default. And we could make an offer for the size of those things, and I'll bet the dollars would come out every time they say no, and we could go back and try to call.
So, you think it's not jurisdictional, and our 30 years of cases, or maybe more, that suggested that it was, or stated that it was, were just wrong. They were overreading the law.
I think we've all operated under the assumption that it is. And frankly, like I said, I don't think the court needs to reach that issue, but I'm not entirely sure that issue has been squarely faced either by this court or some other court. Because, again, there may be some cases I'm missing, but I think practitioners and litigants that operate under the assumption. I don't know if the argument has been made, and I don't know that it's really true here either.
But how do we get at this guy unless there's some evidence about answering why? In other words, let's suppose you've gone in and asked for 100 foot easement at the beginning and offered some money for it, and then when you got the condemnation between you only asked for 50 foot of life, so that we're kind of an apple board. How would you show the offer you made was a good faith unless you put on some evidence of what the 100 foot was?
Well, I think that's enough. If you do not do a reasonable federal investigation prior to the appraisal, like that, you can make an offer on that basis for the 100-foot easement.
So what did the appraiser say about these pertinent rights?
I don't think the appraiser said anything about those rights. Those are rights that are built into the concept of market value.
Is there evidence of that?
That is not in the record. What is in the record is that the company hired an appraiser each and every easement, and they appraised the property for the price of a pipeline.
Did it specify what
kind of pipeline
is
there? No, it's not. What was actually taken, of course.
Well, but in your opinion, that we made a good faith offer, and we relied on this appraisal. Is there any evidence that wasn't the appraisal actually applied? Was it
a
natural gas pipeline, or
a
liquid pipeline, or oil pipeline?
No, it's not in the record. What is in the record is that the appraiser I think that's probably about it.
Thank you, counsel.
Court. My name is Ken Rainey, and I'm here today on behalf of Smith Texas Pipeline, which is one of the two sets of pipeline companies before the court today. I would point out that we are here as a petitioner in three instances and responded to two others. And despite the way the argument is decided, I would just like to call that to my report that we're here in both capacities today. I think it's real important in the remaining time we have to remember this, that 2101-2B4 does not say that the pleading has to show that you were unable to agree to damages in every single term, condition, expressed, implied that may necessarily be involved in an easement and condemnation. It does not say that. And I think that we're here, quite frankly, on a jurisdictional issue. While I agree with my co-counsel that the remedy for fixing it may be different than the way it has been handled in the past, the truth of the matter is you don't have to get to the issue of whether an express warranty clause or whether an assignability clause or whether an expanded use, if I may use that term, is authorized, because this is a threshold issue of jurisdiction. Did we demonstrate that we negotiated and we were unsuccessful? Because it's after jurisdiction attaches that one would get into the issue of, so how much is too much? How much can you pay? What are the incidents that are inherent in the easement, whether it be gotten through voluntary negotiation or through the condemnation process? And I would think all of this has become entirely complicated because we have failed to recognize the unique differences between a voluntary easement and one in condemnation. For example, the landowner signs a voluntary easement. The judge signs the petition of condemnation. Does that mean that you can't specifically enforce the agreement because it's not signed by the landowner? Well, of course not. We've ignored the inherent differences between a real property instrument and a judgment that gets you to the same place but has different facets to it. And if there is a difference, legally, or should be, then you will address that after jurisdiction attaches and not before.
But if the underlying purpose of this is to avoid litigation, which it clearly is, what's wrong with requiring the condemning authority, after whatever negotiations they want, they want to buy the whole fee, that's fine, they can try that. But after all that's failed, as a last step before filing the condemnation proceeding, what's wrong with requiring a demand letter that offers, or an offer letter that offers just a set amount for what you have the legal authority and are going to, in fact, try to condemn, so that the ball's teed up?
Your Honor, in that instance, that assumes that one could not get the warranty or the assignability or these other uses incident to a
No, I'm not going to assume that. I'm going to say the condemning authority decides what it's going to go after in condemnation, like whether they could go after more or not. And then they attempt to make an offer just for that so that the landowner has a chance to accept money in lieu of litigation for exactly what's in controversy.
I believe that those rights were subsumed in the offer that was made. I believe that those rights were inherent in the condemnation process, except for the expanded use. It may well be true that the gas pipeline couldn't put some fluids down through the condemnation process that they might be able to voluntarily agree to get. But other than that, I'm not prepared to stand before this court today and say that it's wrong. The law acts as a substitute for the warranty of title in a condemnation judgment. It's no longer as important to the pipeline company to get an express warranty if you've got a judgment in condemnation that says you have the right to be there. That's just one of the inherent differences, I think, that are prevalent in what you could get voluntarily and what you could get.
Span, this is in the brief on this. You're saying that the agreed settlement you would get does not have the same legal force as a condemnation judgment, so that if you're going to settle, you need a larger bundle of rights?
I'm saying that I believe that there are rights that one gets through a judgment and condemnation as a matter of law that you would have to negotiate for in a voluntary easement because the law would not give you those instant rights under an easement that the law would give you under a condemnation judgment. And that's why I believe there's an inherent difference. I also would like to...
And those, briefly, those rights are?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that there are cases that say that the easement for public use is a sample. Otherwise, under the Supreme Court decision in North Shore Railway Company, you would be giving someone an easement and condemnation for less than what they would otherwise be able to use to take care of the public use. And that's just one example of the rights there. But I would ask the court to also look at BMC Software, Belton versus Marchand, 83 Southwest 3rd, 789. That is y'all's decision last year that deals with the threshold question of jurisdiction in a special appearance case. And I would suggest to the court that reviewing the threshold question by a trial judge and determining whether he or she has jurisdiction in the case is like a special appearance.
Why isn't this more like Dubai? Why isn't this more like Dubai? It's just a statutory requirement. It's not jurisdiction.
Your Honor, I've just assumed, as has been said, that the 30 years of law, that this was something jurisdictional. And to me, the easiest way to fix this is to recognize that the de novo standard of review by the judge, who would necessarily look at the facts and the law necessary for his or her ruling on whether or not to go forward with the case, should be handled on a de novo basis, much the same way that you would in special cases. I'm out of time. I would say this, that the good faith requirement that we're talking about here today has as its purpose preventing needless trips to the courthouse, not creating a jurisdictional never-never land that adds a burden to the system. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
My name is Richard McElhinney. For approximately 35 years, I have represented almost exclusively landowners having property convinced. I appreciate the court's questions so far. However, I don't think the court truly grasps the magnitude of the very real problem.
So the stat we got a statute that simply says the petition must state that the entity and the property owner are unable to agree on the damages. When you're talking about jurisdiction, you said that's got to be a petition. And by the time we got to the courthouse, wasn't it clear in your case that we had a jury trial, they did not agree on the damages. So what's the harm if the offer wasn't precisely tailored to what was ultimately presented? It was clear by the time you got to trial that the landowner was not going to accept what the petitioner's money was.
It wasn't clear because the contending authorities that were made on.
Well, you got the trial. You got the trial. You teed up. You put your experts on. And you were saying it for us there. The man saying it for us that. There was clearly no agreement. Now, why should we reverse the whole condemnation proceeding when there clearly was not a meeting of the minds on there?
Well, these are not arm's length free market transactions. I decided that they were going to walk away. My clients were not made offers. They were threatened with litigation if they didn't give condemning authority something they were not entitled to have. My clients obviously didn't give it to them. That's why we're here.
Well, but they didn't give it to you. Your clients didn't agree when you got the trial. When the condemning authority narrowed it down to just an natural gas pipeline, which none of the bells and whistles that you're complaining about, you still did not agree that the compensation that they were saying the jury should award was adequate. So clearly there was never an agreement on the damage.
At that time, we were before a court that had no jurisdiction. It was an exercise in futility. That's what they had here. And it is jurisdiction. It always has been.
Well, it hasn't always been. It's only been since 1948, but that's a long time. But in the meantime, we decided in the Dubai Petroleum case that sometimes these statutory requirements are just prerequisites to going forward, but not jurisdiction.
This This court has a long line of decisions saying that because this statutory cause of action and a grant of privilege by the legislature, that the provisions dictated by the legislature for the exercise of power and authority may be strictly construed. There are numerous legislative acts granting the authority of the domain for a specific purpose as a basic prerequisite for the trial court to obtain judicial jurisdiction. There must be a condemning authority court acting within the confines of the legislation giving him the power to complain. And in compliance, strict compliance, and in this court's word, without any doubt, and presuming all disputes back in favor of the landowner, there must be strict compliance with the 21 property code.
Let me ask you on that strict compliance issue. I'm troubled by having a rule on this that creates a fact issue any time the landowner and the utility don't agree on what ought to be paid for what's being asked for. It would seem to me you'd always have that. The rule that I'm concerned about that Hubenex argued for, I guess, that Denal says they should have, I don't know how you'd ever say that there was a good faith offer by the utility so long as the seller didn't agree. The utility makes an offer. The seller says you're asking for more than you're entitled to, and then the utility doesn't make another offer. Your position is that that's not a good faith offer. And that can only be because they didn't come back with another offer? Or is that solely because of what they requested in their first demand was not a good faith demand? The buyer does not have to negotiate. You look at the very first piece of paper that comes. If that piece of paper makes an offer for something the buyer doesn't think they're entitled to, then that's the end of the discussion. It's not good faith. And unless the utility comes forward and essentially negotiates against itself, it can never get a good faith negotiation.
In these cases, though, we specifically inquired at the condemning authorities, would they accept an easement that consisted only of what they were able to buy to take? And they said, no, that's not negotiable. Give us what we want, whether we're entitled to it or not, or we will do it.
Without looking at the record, is it fair to say on the other side that the landowners were not willing to give the land for what the condemnors could legally take it for under any set of circumstances?
No, that's not fair. We can't fight that one.
Pardon me?
But we will lose.
What did you say? I'm sorry.
I said that it could have been worked out had they been willing to take what they were legally entitled to take. I don't advise my clients to fight right to take issues, neither, unless I feel there is one. But to show you, Justice has mentioned that there's been drain liquid through gas. That's true. But it fails to grasp the magnitude of the mandate, an easement that will transport anything that will go through a pipe. That's what they were demanding.
So by the time you got to the courthouse, they narrowed it down to natural gas pipeline. They've alleged with the issue. We think it's worth asking. You still weren't willing to accept that?
But they had sued us without ever negotiating with us, as required by the law. Anything that goes to a pipe includes hydrolytes and cyanide.
But they dropped that before. By the time you got to the courthouse steps, they said, okay, here's what we're trying to get, and here's what we think is the value of it, and you said, we disagree.
Mr. Sheffield has stated to the Department of Court of Appeals that they got 90-95% of their easement without litigation. To me, that means 90-95% of the landowners. I mentioned I'm here because we didn't give it to them. If any of my clients had given it to them, on that case, I'd be in front of the grand jury.
But on that point, Mr. McElyea, because your clients didn't agree, they went through condemnation, and as a result, they retained rights they claimed they didn't have to sell. So where is the, ultimately, your clients want to avoid the condemnation because they say it wasn't good faith. But in fact, the clients won on that point. We don't have to sell that to you. We're not going to agree to sell that to you. And the utility said, okay, then we'll go through condemnation, and the utility didn't get those rights. And so they ended up only paying for the rights that the buyers said is the only thing they could obtain. And so, I mean, isn't that how this is supposed to work?
No, sir, because the clients deny the opportunity to resolve it without the extent of litigation. They have to come into court.
Well, if you were willing to accept, once the petition got filed, they're only condemning what they could legally condemn, and you were willing to accept their, what they say the value of that was, why didn't you go into court at that point and say, we're willing to take their offer, but they didn't make a good faith offer, and we want our expenses and time to show up at courthouse door?
Because by that time, we were before a forum that had no jurisdiction. Either one of them probably could reverse any rendition by that court. I find it impossible to believe that Ms. Texas and Sanderson are before you asking you to state that as a public policy, good faith negotiations are the same thing that the legislature has declared criminal under Section 3246 of the Penal Code. If you secure the execution of a document affecting real property by deception, deception is defined in 3101. And that value is more than $1,500, it's a felony. And they're asking you to call felonies good faith simply because it's a one-time offer of money making.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief recess.
All rise.